It's a somewhat somber song set in Louisiana from the Doobie Brothers. Sounds good after all these years. We're talking with Ethan Brown, the author of Murder in the Bayou, a very compelling book about the murders of 8 women, all of them prostitutes, all of them drug users, all of them at one time or another police snitches. There are other commonalities, including links to a guy named Frankie Richard, who was a pimp and a drug dealer and sort of a semi-king of the streets at that time. When we come back, we pick up the conversation about how he was linked to all the victims and what role he played in this story. And then some of the difficulties that Ethan Brown faced in getting public documents and some of the threats that came along with his investigation. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Ethan, before the break, you were introducing this character, Frankie Richard, who... you describe him. I mean, he was a pimp. He was a strip club owner, a drug dealer. And is it too much to say that he was sort of the racket's boss of the town at the time?
Oh, it's not too much to say. So Frankie is a Jennings native who, as I said, spent a lot of time out of town in the 90s, kind of building up his street rep in Lafayette, which is about a half an hour east of Jennings. And he comes back to Jennings in the early 2000s, comes back home at a time when the prescription pill trade is taking off out there. And there'd actually obviously be a national rise in prescription pill abuse around that time. And he also takes advantage of a kind of flourishing sex trade at the time. And to sort of add to another piece to all this, he has significant law enforcement connections, which he leverages.
And how do you know that?
Well, a couple of ways. So in the 2007 murder of Kristen Gary Lopez, I mentioned at the very beginning, the sheriff's office investigator who was disciplined for selling a vehicle that may have been used in some way in Kristen's case. Right after that murder, actually several months after, two inmate witnesses, female inmate witnesses, went to a detective with the Jennings Police Department and told the detective that they were told directly by members of Frankie Richard's family, his associates, that Frankie worked hand in hand with this sheriff's office investigator to dispose of this vehicle and clean it of physical evidence. That's sort of how we know it, part one. Part two is, in 2009, at the very sort of tail end of this case, Frankie was surveilled socializing with a number of members of the sheriff's office out there. And he was surveilled by a private investigator who has worked on this case on and off and other folks. And there was a raid on Frankie's house, a raid unrelated to this case, but a raid nonetheless. And evidence in that raid disappeared. And one of the sheriff's office's employees who had been seen socializing with Frankie was held responsible for that evidence disappearing. And the fact that that evidence disappeared resulted in this case collapsing against Frankie. And indeed, when I spoke to Frankie about this happening, he said, "I'd like to thank that person for getting rid of the evidence in that case."
I mean, it's astonishing. You mentioned about the vehicle. I mean, didn't say it here, but in the book, the picture is painted that it's a pretty good chance that this vehicle was used to transport the body of one of the women who was murdered. And then a cop buys it, cleans it out, and sells it at a considerable profit, turns it over really quickly before anybody really takes the time to go through it and look for any kind of physical evidence, any CSI team. And then, mentioning about evidence disappearing, seems that that happens a lot in this parish. I mean, drugs disappearing, cash disappearing. As you say, the street people, the drug dealers would say, as soon as there's a big bust on the highway, we know that those drugs are going to be sold soon enough on the street.
And this is the kind of misconduct out in Jeff Davis that is committed by very high level people. For example, the police chief, the very top cop in Jennings, a guy named Johnny Lassiter, was indicted by the state several years back. He's no longer the police chief for stealing drugs out of the evidence room. So yeah, it's a remarkable thing. And going back quickly to the vehicle that may have played a role in the Kristen Gary Lopez case, the sheriff at the time, Ricky Edwards, said, "Oh, we didn't know this vehicle had anything to do with this case. It's just a mistake. This happened. The investigator was disciplined for this, and let's all move on," right? I obtained the DA file in the Kristen Gary Lopez case, and one of the things that's remarkable is that you see that the sheriff's office knew that this truck may have played a role in this case from the very, very beginning. So the notion that, "Well, we didn't know, it was just a mistake," is a lie. They knew that this truck may have played a role in this case from almost day one.
You have these conversations with Frankie Richard. You describe a scene where he's sitting on the front porch, and he's being very seemingly honest and collegial, and but it's an amazing. I don't know how you talked him into speaking to you, but he seemed to enjoy the conversation. And one of the themes that he seems to advance in the book brazenly is that, hey, I think maybe the cops are behind the murder of all these women.
Yes, he does advance that. Yes. And sometimes it will be, he will advance the cops are behind this theory to move blame off of him, obviously, right? So he one of his favorites is he will pin all the murders on a deceased sheriff's deputy, and say, "Oh, well, all the murders stopped after he died."
Well, we're
And
talking about the
he was
cop who
gone.
would cru who allegedly
Right.
cruised town with his wife, picked up hookers, and took them home to his house in the sex ring.
Exactly. So Frankie Richard is very fond of saying that that deputy who's deceased is responsible for all the murders. And there's a clear reason, obviously, right, why he would say that, which is it exculpates him, right? Suddenly, it's all on a dead guy, not him. And that part of it isn't very credible. The part that is credible is not so much what he says, because he's loath to talk about this, but it's the connections that he has to various members of the sheriff's office. Whether they're socializing at his house, disappearing evidence in his cases. That part of it is very, very credible.
All eight women had ties to prostitution. Did all eight women have ties to his prostitution outfit? Did he run all of them at one
Yeah.
time or another?
Well, I wouldn't say all. According to him, actually, and I believe he said this fairly straightforwardly to me, I believe he said seven of eight of them were connected to him through sort of sex work business, working as a pimp or whatnot.
So as the bodies start piling up, I mean, there's a chill that runs through town. The police are sort of letting the story spread that maybe there's a serial killer in their midst. The people on this, the bad side of the tracks, the people who live there in that lifestyle, they know something's up, including some of the women. I mean, you describe it as the death toll mounts. Some of the women who were eventually murdered sort of had the feeling that maybe they might be next.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, South Jennings is very small, and the milieu of these women is even smaller, obviously. So once individuals start disappearing from this milieu, and you've got two, three, four, five, then yes, absolutely, there's a terror amongst these women that they're going to be next. And they were indeed next. I believe I quote this in the book. In 2008, very late 2008, a witness went to the task force and said that Nicole Guillory, a woman named Nicole Guillory from South Jennings, was going to be the next victim. And indeed, she was the next victim in July-ish of 2009. She was the eighth and final victim. So yeah, so you have this very real fear among this milieu that they're going to be next, and then you have an actual witness coming forward and correctly naming the next victim. It's remarkable.
There were other murders too that toward the end of the
Yes.
book you rattle off a couple of examples of people tangentially connected to this. They don't count
Yes.
as part of the Jeff Davis eight, but you think there are other victims who
Oh yeah, and the book understates the other victims quite significantly. So, for example, there was a drug dealer in town named Harvey Burleigh, who was very close with many of these women. And in 2007, in the midst of all of this, he said that he was poking around town and had some good sort of leads as to what was going on. He was then murdered, and his murder remains unsolved. There's a drug dealer from South Jennings who dated at least two of the victims. His name was David Desitel. He was murdered in 2011. His murder remains unsolved. I was just out in Southwest Louisiana doing some book events, and I was approached by a number of women from a town called Welch in Jeff Davis Parish, which is even smaller than Jennings. It's tiny. And I was regaled with stories of unsolved homicides in Welch, many of them. So yeah, there are a remarkable number of unsolved homicides in this parish, and there's a significant number of that remarkable number that are connected to these eight.
So tell me about the risks of putting this story together. You've had to travel a lot. You're traveling alone. You know you're in
Right.
some pretty dangerous necks of the woods. And you were told flat out, I think more than once, hey, you're never going to see this book published.
Right. So, I've been working on this, like I think I mentioned way at the beginning here. I've been working on this for about 5 years, and I think I was fortunate in one way to have started working on this in 2011-ish, which was a relatively quiet time for this case. There was a lot of media about this case in 2008, 2009, and the beginning of 2010. And actually, the New York Times piece that I referenced was January 1st, 2010. You didn't really see much after that. So there's a pretty quiet period there, and that's when I begin looking at this. And I'm going out there during this very quiet period. Nobody's really paying much attention to me. That started to change significantly. In 2014, I published a long-form piece about this at a place called Medium, a website called Medium, and the piece was an extraordinary success. It got everybody's attention down here, and even nationally, the Attorney General of Louisiana had to address it, And the sheriff of Jeff Davis Parish, who was actually fairly new at the time, he'd taken over from Ricky Edwards, who was the sheriff during the Jeff Davis A period. His name's Ivy Woods. He's still the sheriff out there. He actually put up a personal message about me on the sheriff's office website that remains up there. And yeah, so things really changed from 2014 to the present. I was no longer working on this in an under the radar way. I was no longer working on this at a time when the story was quiet. So, and and the sheriff's office personal message about me was just one of many examples of moments where I was targeted by folks out
What
there.
did the message say?
It was bizarre. It called me a writer of fiction stories, I believe, and I've never written fiction in my life. And that may have been some kind of odd swipe at my work, being, that he thinks it's fiction. I'm not sure. It was really poorly written, so it was hard to tell what he meant. There was a line in the message that was basically saying, keep these out-of-town troublemakers out of here, kind of thing, about me. Which was also odd because, as a number of people have mentioned who read it, you, meaning me, Ethan Brown, live in Louisiana. So how are you sort of a this kind of outside agitator person? I think this parish is so small that even though I live in Louisiana, I'm sort of an alien presence nonetheless out there.
Implying that, hey, why aren't you being a team player here? Or, but you were also told more directly to your face by, I think, somebody, some of Frankie Richard's associates during one of the times when you met to see him, right?
Yes, I was. One of Frankie Richard's associates told me that I would be dead, essentially, if I was to interfere with the cops' business out there. That's right. And then, I got all sorts of messages while I was working on this. Oh, you're not going to live to see the book's publication. Things of that nature, basically.
Well, at least, I guess everybody in your line of work gets those kind of threats from time to time. At least it's enough to make you look in the rear view mirror once in a while or around corners before you go into dark alleys. Talk to me about dealing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. No, go ahead.
Talk to me about dealing with the police and trying to get public records. I mean, the book is meticulously documented. You've got statements from witnesses and documents that seemingly haven't surfaced anywhere else. I would imagine, even armed with public records laws, that it was tough to get what you requested.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So Louisiana, surprisingly, has a great Public Records Act. So, for example, personnel files of cops are public record. I don't know individual laws state by state, but my understanding is that that's not the case in many places.
Well, it's not the
So
case
the
here in
public
Nevada,
record.
that's for sure.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So the Public Records Act here is quite good. And this touches back to what I said a moment ago about me starting this during a very quiet time. So I was doing the majority of my Public Records Act requests years ago,
I'll tell you what,
and
Ethan, I shouldn't have asked that question because it's going to take a little time. The music's telling us we need to go in a break. We'll pick up that part of the conversation right after Creedence Clearwater Revival takes us into this break. Back with more Coast to Coast in a moment. That's a clever lyricist and songwriter, talented songwriter named Jim Stafford. An old song called Swamp Witch, figured it works in the week leading up to Halloween. We're talking with Ethan Brown about his book, Murder in the Bayou. in a moment. We'll take a couple of calls, in particular, if there's anyone out there from Louisiana, anyone from the who is listening tonight in the Jeff Davis Parish who might have some insight into these unsolved murders. We'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. So before the break, Ethan, you were telling me about public records laws in Louisiana being pretty good. So you had ways to get access to some files that maybe reporters in other parts of the country would not see.
Yeah, that's right. So Louisiana's public records law is very good. And I started requesting records in this case years ago when the case was very quiet. And honestly, the response was simply, here are your records. And here's the bill for them. So, it was actually pretty frictionless for years while working on this case. And the change only came about 3 to 4 years into it, after I'd published my long form piece about this case in 2014, which got a lot of attention. After that piece in 2014, there was a lot more pushback, and there were redactions and whatnot to my requests. But generally speaking, actually, particularly because I was starting all this at a very quiet time in the case, there was not a lot of pushback, surprisingly.
What is the attitude of the cops? I mean, In this context, I would think that the murders of 8 women and then other people, even though it's on the bad side of the tracks, the folks on the good side of the tracks would demand some action, would say, hey, this is spooky stuff. We need this to be solved. You know, as you mentioned earlier, at some point a task force is created. There are federal agencies involved. You've been able to put together a pretty convincing case about the people right. responsible for these murders. Where's the federal action? Where's the pressure on police to solve this thing and file some charges?
It's a good question. You know, I think it's a good, very good question. It's complicated. So on the one hand, and this is something that's been very disappointing to me to see, the federal and state task force on this that I've referenced a bunch of times called MATE, the federal presence on it is very significant, much more significant than I'd imagined. And this task force has been around since 2008. And to my surprise, FBI agents have sat in on multiple interviews where all sorts of credible allegations of serious law enforcement misconduct are made. So the thing that I find frustrating about it is what happens to that? What has happened to that? Why isn't there, for example, action from DOJ civil rights on this? DOJ civil rights looks very closely at police misconduct. And then, you know, the other piece of this is that, you know, the task force, sort of central to the task force is the Jeff Davis Parish Sheriff's Office. And to me, there's an inherent conflict of interest there because the Sheriff's Office is at the center of the task force, yet current and former employees of the Sheriff's Office have been named as suspects in this case. So, I think that, meaning the role of the Sheriff's Office Task Force, is a big, big hurdle here to getting this solved.
You lay out the case for, I think, almost all of the murders, if not all of them, about who did it. You've got documents and witness statements, and, I mean, you don't exactly come right out and spell it and accuse the individuals of murder, but you lay out the evidence for each one of them. I mean, these murders are solvable.
Yes, I think they are solvable. I think that's right. I I tend to believe that the reason they're not being solved is that whenever you look at these cases, they implicate people in power, and that it then becomes very difficult to solve them.
Well, we're not, when you say power, we're not just talking about police officials, because as you, it's, I don't want to spoil the whole book, but I mean, a lot of the action and the activity is centered on one particular inn in the town, where all these
Right.
women stayed at one time or another, where a lot of prostitution activity took place. You tried to track down who owns this inn, and it led you to some interesting places.
Right. So, from the late 90s through 2008, one of the hubs of drugs and sex trafficking in the parish was a place called the Boudreaux Inn. I was able to, for example, track down a number of sheriff's office incident reports placing many of the people in this Jeff Davis milieu at the Boudreaux Inn. And then I did a bunch of other work to determine who was running the place. And the Boudreaux Inn was run by a field representative for a congressman down here in Louisiana.
Well, I mean, maybe that has something to do with why there's no seemingly no interest on the part of federal agencies to jump on it.
I mean, it's hard to say. My unfortunately, I have to be extremely limited in my comments about this,
Yes.
because the congressman has filed a defamation suit against me and my publisher, and I can't comment in any way on pending litigation. And I sort of just have to refer folks back to what I reported in the book there.
Let me ask you this, and then we'll take a couple of calls. What will
Sure.
it take then? What will it take to come to a resolution on this?
I don't know. That's a good question. I thought about this a lot, and I think I'll sort of touch back on something I said way at the beginning of this, that it's hard to imagine what justice looks like in this case. Because they've been unsolved for so long, because there's so much law enforcement misconduct in them, one possible avenue for resolution in this would be for it to be investigated by DOJ civil rights and brought prosecution. They had a very mixed record on it, but they did bring prosecutions in here in New Orleans, where I live, in two cases. One was a man who was killed named Henry Glover, who was murdered in the wake of Katrina by New Orleans police officers. Another was called the Danziger Bridge case, same sort of circumstances, post-Katrina case, where police officers killed a number of individuals. DOJ civil rights came in those cases, mixed record as far as how they went in court. And then there was also a DOJ consent decree on the New Orleans Police Department to implement a number of reforms on the NOPD. That's a plausible route for this. Is it going to solve the parish's problems? No. Is it a really difficult path, as proven by the Henry Glover and Danziger cases? Yes, it is.
Let's take a call or two. We'll start with the wild card line. Al, good morning, Al. You're on with Ethan Brown talking about his book, Murder in the Bayou. What's on your mind?
Good morning, guys. Hey, listen. If you think, listen. Louisiana does not guarantee you a jury trial in a criminal case. That's totally unconstitutional. And there is a lot of articles they have, it's stated in the articles, it's stated in the amendments, Sixth Amendment, and then Article 2, Section 3, and also in the middle of the Declaration of Independence, there's this statement for depriving us, of, in many cases, of the benefits of trials by jury. Now, this involves, you know, a misdemeanor case, but my case, and in fact, two cases that I went through, two trials, I realize that you can waive your right to a jury trial, but this was done unilaterally by the prosecution, you know, in two cases, and in my case, and you know, in both cases, the Monday before my trial, I called the FBI and filed charges, and the FBI did save me from going to jail, but they absolutely did not take care of this situation. This started 10 years ago, and it's still going on. Now, how can this be that this state is like an enemy of the Constitution? And another thing, if you have to go the public defender route, the lawyer is assigned to the court, not to the client.
I'll tell you what, Al. Let's get Ethan to chime in here before we get too far off the track. Ethan, are you familiar with what Al's describing as the jury situation?
I'm somewhat familiar with it, but not entirely. And then, as far as the public defender situation, you know, Louisiana, you know, has a public defender board that has individual public defender offices. So they've moved away, from the kind of system that you're talking about. That's actually fairly commonplace in other states where, you know, you have a judge making appointments for public defense, and the judge even, you know, steps in and you know, cuts off funding and whatnot for public defense. So, yeah, I'm not sure that the public defense system you're describing is exactly what happened down here.
All right. Well, thanks, Al, for calling in. Yeah. East of the Rockies, Julie is calling from Nebraska, but she used to live in that area and might have some insight. Hi, Julie.
Hello. I was a dancer in not far from the area that all this stuff occurred. And another friend of mine that was a dancer, we actually were witnesses to something that happened during that time. And for one reason or another, no one really did anything too bad to us. But just to tell you what it's like down there, I'd hoped it gotten a little better. But we were basically, I guess you would say, kidnapped, because that's exactly what happened, although they took us out to dinner and were really nice at first and took us to a nice hotel and everything. And we were taken to a place in a town called Palouses, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. That's near Lafayette. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. And there's a cat house there, and it's called The Gate. Now, when you drive in, it doesn't look like a cat house. It looks like a beautiful little ranch house out in the middle of nowhere. When you drive in, there's a thing that you roll over, like in a gas station, that dings. And that lets everyone in the house know that a customer has come in. And when the customers come in, basically, we were taken there and forced it to be prostitutes. When the customer comes in, all the girls run to their mirrors and fluff up their hair and make sure their sleazy little outfits look good, and then you run down to this area called the bar, because it looks exactly like a bar. And then the customers come in the door, and they're all laughing and having a good old time. A lot of the customers were some of these people that he's been talking about in the in the police departments and areas like that, one of the songs on the jukebox was songs by the sheriff, the first sheriff that he was speaking of, on the jukebox. Every time he came in, which was at least once a week, they would play it. Huh. And he would, it was the song, "I'm Going to Kansas City," except he gave a different Louisiana town, which I won't even say the name of that town anymore. So I finally got out of there, and I'm surprised I did, because...
How long were you there, Julie?
I was there for 2 months. The only reason I got out, the reason that we are still alive, is because of who I was. And it wasn't enough to keep me totally safe, but it was enough to keep me alive, thank God. The things I had to go through to get out were unbelievable. And, like, at one point, I cut all my hair off and scratched my face up so I would look horrible. There was a woman and a man that ran the place. The woman was the really mean one. The guy was okay, but she was a whip cracker. And some of the girls actually wanted to be there. But they've got 40% of the cut, and the people that ran the place got 60%. But I had to do all kinds of horrible things to get out. And when I did, it was a really bad scene, too, until I finally found somebody that would rescue me. This was just 1996. This stuff's still going on there. And it's completely common, so I'm not surprised when you say the people on the other side of town didn't do anything, because this stuff goes on there everywhere. It always has. I mean, all you have to do is say the last name Edwards, and that will pretty much get you out of any kind of trouble, you know? And that's pretty much the whole state.
Julie, I appreciate you calling in. We're about out of time for this segment. I appreciate your story. You might want to write to Ethan, drop him an email or something, so the two of you can continue this conversation. Ethan, you want to react to that?
I don't know what to say. Yeah, I'm incredibly sorry. That's just horrifying. And if you wanted to talk some more, certainly contact me. I'm just very sorry.
You know, I've heard those stories from prostitutes in Las Vegas who had escaped that were basically held as sex slaves in Louisiana at something very similar to what Julie was describing there. It's a story that is familiar to me. That's amazing. Well, Ethan, I wish you luck in your quest to pursue this. I hope you stay safe and that you prevail in the legal action, and let us know if you get a breakthrough, and maybe you can come back and talk about the book, Murder in the Bayou, and it's a really great piece of work.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I look forward to talking to you again. So that's Ethan Brown. Murder in the Bayou is the name of the book. We're going to switch gears here in a moment to talk about a cult. The creation of a cult. A new TV series has been produced about a particular cult. Well-meaning folks, well-educated folks who pursue enlightenment and then find themselves trapped in something that they can't get out of. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM.